Duncan is invented. What Duncan describes is not. It is happening across east of England right now. This is their story. In Huntingdon, NHS workforce planning has trapped qualified healthcare workers between empty training places and understaffed wards. The gap between what the health service needs and what Treasury spending rules allow has left people with years of experience unable to access the nursing courses that would put them exactly where hospitals are crying out for staff.
My name is Duncan, and I've wanted to be a nurse since I was 16, not because of some grand calling, but because it made sense. My father spent 30 years as a paramedic with East of England Ambulance Service, and I grew up understanding that healthcare was about being there when people needed you most. After studying biology at Anglia Ruskin University, I took a job as a healthcare assistant at Hinchingbrook Hospital. 5 years in, watching the nurses I worked alongside, I knew that was where I belonged. In 2022, I applied to Health Education England, East of England, for adult nursing training back at Anglia Ruskin. I had every qualification they asked for, 5 years of ward experience, references from consultants who'd watched me work. The application process was thorough but straightforward. I was confident. The rejection letter arrived in May. Not because I wasn't qualified, but because there were only 180 funded places for over 400 qualified applicants. I called the admissions coordinator to understand what had gone wrong. "Nothing went wrong," she told me. "The Treasury has capped our budget. We simply cannot afford to fund more training places." It sounded reasonable. Budgets have limits. I understood that. I reapplied for 2023, thinking maybe my luck would change. Same result, same explanation, same apologetic tone from the same coordinator, who clearly hated delivering the news as much as I hated hearing it. But something wasn't sitting right. In my lunch breaks at Hinchingbrook, I'd walk past the job boards. Agency nursing shifts advertised at £40 per hour because they couldn't fill permanent positions. Ward managers pulling double shifts. Patients waiting longer for basic care because there simply weren't enough hands. I decided to visit the campus where I'd hoped to study. Anglia Ruskin's nursing school is a proper facility, built for training. But when I walked through during what should have been peak teaching hours, entire lecture halls sat empty. I asked a student where everyone was. "This is all of us," she said, gesturing to the half-full classroom. "They built this place for 320 nursing students, but they only fund 180 places. These rooms could be full." That was when the pieces started connecting in ways that didn't match what I'd been told. I started asking questions I hadn't thought to ask before. I tracked down some of the graduates from previous years who couldn't find work, not because they weren't qualified, but because NHS trusts kept saying the same thing. There is no funding for new positions. These were people who'd completed their training, passed their exams, and wanted nothing more than to work in the hospitals that were crying out for staff. I met Sarah, a newly qualified nurse from Suffolk, in a coffee shop near Addenbrookes. She'd been unemployed for 8 months since graduating. "I apply for everything," she told me. "They always say the same thing. We'd love to have you, but the budget has been cut. We cannot afford to run that programme." Meanwhile, the same trusts were paying agency staff double or triple what they'd pay a permanent employee to fill the same shifts. When I took this contradiction back to NHS England, asking how they could justify turning away qualified applicants while paying premium rates for temporary staff, I was put through to a workforce planning manager. She was more candid than I'd expected. "We know there's demand and capacity," she admitted, "but Treasury spending rules treat training investment as government expenditure to be minimised, not as the pipeline that gets qualified nurses onto wards." That conversation changed everything for me. I'd been accepting the logic that there was no money, as though it was a law of physics. But the same government that told me it couldn't find enough pounds to train nurses was happy to spend pounds on agency contracts that cost far more. I started seeing the pattern everywhere. Empty training facilities that could accommodate twice as many students, unemployed, qualified nurses who couldn't get permanent positions, hospitals paying premium rates for temporary staff to fill the gaps that permanent staff would fill for less money, and at every level, the same explanation: there is no funding. But I began to understand something I hadn't grasped before. The government that issues the pound was telling me it couldn't find enough pounds to connect the people who wanted to work with the places that needed them. That wasn't an accounting problem, it was a political choice. The real question was never whether the money existed. Money is what the government creates when it spends. The question was whether the people existed, whether the facilities existed, whether the need existed. All of them did. The training halls at Anglia Ruskin were there. The candidates who met every requirement were there. The hospital wards that needed more permanent staff were there. What wasn't there was the political will to spend the pounds that would connect them. I used to accept the excuse that there was no money. I hear it differently now. The government that prints the notes and mints the coins told me it could not find enough of them to train the people who were standing right there, ready to work. The real question was never about money. It was about whether the people existed, whether the skills could be taught, whether the materials were available. They were, all of them. The excuse was not a fact. It was a choice wrapped in the language of impossibility. It is the same logic as a household that says, we cannot afford it, except a household does not issue its own currency. The government does. The limit was never the money. The limit was the willingness to spend it into the places and the people who needed it. I am still here, still watching, still asking the questions that don't get asked in the meetings where these decisions are made. Because what happened to me isn't just my story. It's the story of every constituency where qualified people and urgent needs exist side by side, while someone in Westminster insists the cupboard is bare.
What Duncan experienced has a name: fake experts. This technique works by citing economists or commentators who treat the household budget myth as self-evident truth, as though repeating it makes it real. Consider how tobacco companies used to wheel out scientists who insisted smoking was safe, carefully selecting only those who supported their position while ignoring the overwhelming evidence to the contrary. In Duncan's case, every official he spoke to cited unnamed Treasury spending rules as though these were natural laws rather than political choices. When he pushed back, they appealed to economic orthodoxy without naming specific economists or acknowledging that the profession is deeply divided on government spending. The austerity objection Duncan encountered was typical. Economists say we cannot spend more on health without causing inflation. But which economists? The profession is divided. Many macroeconomists argue the binding constraint is real capacity, not currency. Economists say without naming them is an appeal to unnamed authority. The UK government issues its own currency. It does not need to find pounds before it spends them. The real constraint is resources: people, skills, materials, time. And in Duncan's constituency, those resources were sitting idle. Empty lecture halls that could train 320 students but only funded 180. Qualified candidates turned away while hospitals paid premium rates for agency staff. The resources existed. The people existed. The decision not to connect them was political, not financial. Huntingdon ranks 450 out of 543 English constituencies on the deprivation index, placing it in decile 9. English Indices of Deprivation 2025, MHCLG. The constituency has 2,584 registered charities, Charity Commission Register, Dower, England and Wales. Total grants received amount to £15.7 million, 360 giving grant NAV. All sources are published at blockedbritain.co.uk. Blocked Britain tells the stories of people whose lives are shaped by the gap between what Britain needs and what its institutions choose to provide. Every character is fictional. Every situation is drawn from official statistics. Produced by Blocked Britain.